Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. As this afternoon, well, just the afternoon, October 14, 2020, we're discussing the Staggers Act turning 40. Lessons learned from railroad regulation. I'm Nick Marr. I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our experts. We've got a couple panelists here, but I'm just going to introduce our moderator this afternoon, Lawrence Spiwak. He's the president of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Public Policy Studies. Larry's going to introduce our other panelists. And as a note for the audience, we'll be looking for audience questions towards the end of the call. So be thinking of those as we're going along and have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. All right, well, thanks for being with us here today, Larry. I'll give the floor out to you now.
Thanks a lot, Nick. And welcome, everybody. We appreciate you joining us. The title of today's Teleforum is The Staggers Act Turns 40, Lessons Learned from Railroad Regulation. And anytime a law turns 40 years old, it's always good to sort of look at it. But what's interesting, at least to me, as we think about the Staggers Act and we look at the current environment in which we are in, there are, and this is why I think looking at the Staggers Act is an excellent time to do so right now. There's a lot of talk about imposing public utility regulation across many sectors. As Federal Trade Commissioner Christine Wilson recently wrote in a law review, and she said this publicly in a couple speeches, heavy sectoral regulation is back in vogue. And what's interesting is that a lot of people are pointing to rail regulation as a great example of fantastic regulation of which we should emulate. So now that we've got the Staggers Act turning 40, why don't we look at rail regulation and see how that's worked out, what's been good and what's been bad. To talk about that, we have a really outstanding panel. First, we are very lucky to have Tim Strafford, who is the Associate General Counsel and Corporate Secretary of the Association of American Railroads. So he really is one of our country's leading experts in railroad regulation. And we are also joined by the Phoenix Center's Chief Economist, Dr. George Ford. And George has done also some work in the railroad field in terms of investment and financial health. So hopefully we'll have a really good discussion today and see what we can find out. So let's start, I think, probably for those who are unfamiliar with the Staggers Act, with the background of the Staggers Act, when it was passed, how it came to be, sort of the history of it. And again, as we have Tim as one of the experts on it. Tim, if you wouldn't mind sort of starting us off with a little bit of history, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thanks, Larry. You know, it's interesting as you sort of, you know, made reference to comments about rail regulation. You know, I think for those of you who don't toil in this field, and I pretty much know everybody who does, so there aren't that many of us. It's easy to fall into sort of a thumbnail sketch of regulation, of sort of robber barons of the 19th century, and then regulation, and I guess everything worked out fine. And, you know, in some ways, you know, the regulatory paradigm we have today is a strong one, but it took a lot of pain and work to get there. You know, the Interstate Commerce Commission was the very first regulatory commission created back in 1877, and, you know, was regulating an industry, sort of a new technology that sort of revolutionized commerce in the United States. And over time, the regulation of railroads, you know, didn't necessarily reflect the changing dynamics, the changing economy, changing technologies. Regulation tends to favor stability over everything else, and favor the status quo and sort of maybe even entrenched interests. And so over the years, you know, as technology changed and markets changed and sort of the automobile was invented. Interstate trucking came along. Interstate highway came along. The competitive landscape for railroads changed dramatically, and regulation didn't necessarily. I mean, you had a regulatory regime that sort of protected competitors and not competition. You know, if you go and look at some old ICC decisions, it's pretty striking and very different than the way we think about competition today, as the commission was focused on sort of protecting weak competitors and protecting what they call the inherent advantages of each mode, and that cutthroat competition was to be discouraged, and railroads shouldn't be undercutting traffic that moved by barge and things like that. Rates and service were regulated. Railroads lived in a collective rate-making world. Railroads, under the auspices of the ICC, had to get together and collectively set rates through things called rate bureaus, and the ICC regulated minimum and maximum rates. Railroads also had severe constraints on them on the cost side. If a railroad wanted to discontinue or abandon service on a line that was not profitable, it was very difficult to do so. They had to get permission from the agency, and standards very much favored the preservation of service. There was also a common carrier obligation to provide passenger service, whether or not those services made money. And so, as you can imagine, all of those sort of cumulative effects of that sort of heavy-handed regulation on top of increasing competition from a more flexible competitor led the railroad industry to sort of a state of financial ruin. You know, before Enron, the largest corporate bankruptcy in the United States was the Penn Central Railroad. During the 70s, most railroads in the Northeast were in bankruptcy, and actually more than 20% of all of the rail miles in the United States was being operated by railroads in bankruptcy. Railroads couldn't earn returns on their investment. By the 70s, they were less than 3%, in some years down close to 2%. And as a result of regulation and other things, the market share for intercity freight fell dramatically. It was a sort of an untenable state of affairs. And, you know, we're talking about the Staggers Act today, and sort of that was a culmination in 1980 of a deregulatory effort, but it's not it wasn't a singular lightning bolt. There were a number of incremental steps to get there. First, the Passenger Rail Act of 1970, relieving carriers of the obligation to provide passenger service. The Regional Rail Reorganization Act and the Railroad Revitalization and Regulatory Reform Act, 1976, you know, affectionately referred to as the 3R and 4R Acts, were all sort of incremental steps to sort of dismantle this regulatory regime. And sort of at that stage, the nation was at this fork in the road or a switch in the railroad to decide whether that they were going to go down the road of sort of subsidizing freight rail, sort of a nationalization paradigm, or to deregulate and to allow markets and demand for service to sort of dictate outcomes in the rail industry. Fortunately, they picked the latter. The Staggers Rail Act of 1980 chose to partially deregulate the rail industry, allowed market forces to work, recognized really that railroads operate in competitive transportation markets. And as such, you know, demand for service and competition should determine outcomes. And in those rare instances where there is not effective competition, regulation may be appropriate, but that regulation should mimic competitive outcomes. And the results have been striking. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a second. But just in terms of specifics of what Staggers did, you know, put an end to this collective rate making in almost all circumstances, there's very limited antitrust immunity for certain interline where railroads have to connect to complete a movement. It legalized contracts between railroads and their customers. Customers could enter into confidential rail contracts and lock in service and other standards. It recognized the need for railroads to earn adequate revenues and required the agency to regulate in a way that promoted revenue adequacy, almost a regulation of the regulator. It required showings of market dominance before rates could be regulated. That meaning that there had to be showing that there was no effective competition before the agency would intervene in rate matters. It allowed and actually directed the agency to the greatest extent practicable to exempt traffic from regulation where there was competition. And finally, it allowed railroads to abandon unprofitable lines and thus rationalize their system. I've been talking for a while now, and I feel like I should probably pause and let Larry chime in. But that's sort of the landscape that staggers change. It was really a decisive shift towards markets and market outcomes.
Well, let me just ask you a follow-up question, Tim, and then I'm going to get to George, because I think there's a really important point about the history of rail regulation is that prior to the Staggers Act, and correct me if I'm wrong, but really the over-regulation of the industry really led to almost the industry's financial collapse. And so it was a major congressional policy to ensure the financial health of the railroad. Again, we had these massive bankruptcies that were going on all over the place. And just talk about that a little bit, because then we can get to George's analysis of sort of the financial health of the industry, which I think is important. But just elaborate on that point just real quick, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So you had an industry that was struggling to attract capital. Investors were leaving in droves, and rail companies had to find even alternate businesses to generate returns. And the deregulatory effort really focused on the notion that railroads needed to be regulated in a way that allowed them to attract capital in order to allow them to invest in their private networks. I mean, you can imagine a company that's earning, you know, a 2% return on investment does not have the financial capital to invest for growth, certainly. They didn't even have capital to make necessary maintenance spends. You know, the state of the rail network in the United States declined. The term entered the railroad lexicon, standing derailment, the notion that a rail car would fall over standing still just because of the condition of the track. So I don't think it's too extreme to say that the nation's rail system was facing a potential crisis, and that sort of focused the attention of policymakers on the need to allow investment in the network.
So then it's interesting, again, about this regulation is that unlike your sort of standard rate making, which is, you know, J&R, just and reasonable standards, we'll get into that. But, you know, the financial health really was a very motivating factor. And would you say that sort of pervades sort of It's a key goal in railroad regulation is to make sure, particularly as it's critical infrastructure, that this is, I think, somewhat unique in a rate-making statute, but that is a key congressional objective here. Would that be safe to say that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's explicit in the statute, both in sort of the policy section, the rail transportation policy, as well as the various rate provisions that the agency must consider the revenue adequacy of the rail carrier, and actually the agency is actually directed to regulate in a way to promote adequate revenues.
Well, that's I think that's a very important thing that, you know, again, going back to was rail regulation sort of this model that we want to look to, and that, you know, overregulation actually harmed, I mean, we had bankruptcies, and I think that's an important, so this is constant, and that goes to just how the STB, as you said a moment ago, Surface Transportation Board, let me throw in the acronym there, correct, how it does it. So let me then turn here to George. You did a paper last December on infrastructure investment in the railroad industry. Could you sort of walk us through what you found there, George, if you wouldn't mind?
Well, that was a big issue, as we just discussed, is the investment in the in railroad infrastructure and how that had become a serious problem under the regulatory regime and the increasing competition, which combined to put great financial stress on the railroads. And so we have in the policy revenue adequacy, which is basically regulating the regulator, is what I like to call it, where the acts of regulation can't be so aggressive as to threaten the returns of the railroad companies, at least to the extent that that revenue is adequate to cover expenses and to maintain investment levels. What I wanted to do is to see, because the argument had been made, of course, that increased regulation would threaten investment in the sector. So I took some data on investment in the industry and also data on its return on investment and its cost of capital. And then we could see how the relationship between the health of the sector and health of the railroad business, and how revenues were impacted by its revenue. The regulations that have been talked about recently would cut revenues, and so I used revenues to as the determinant of investment. And what you find is you might think that revenues and investment are related to each other, not just correlated with each other, but this was a time series model, vector autoregression, where we could actually quantify the impact of changes in revenue on investment, and found statistically significant and a positive relationship between the two. And in fact, that the marginal relationship is pretty close to the average relationship in the industry. So if you look at investment per dollar revenue, that's pretty close to what the marginal impact is as well. The paper also has some analysis of sort of the history of the return in the industry relative to its cost of capital using data put together by the STB. And we see really only in most recent years has the return on investment approached the cost of capital. And in some years has exceeded it, but it's a highly variable series. And I think part of the reason you hear some talk about re-regulating the industry is that the return has finally come back to what we might describe as a competitive return, and the fact that threshold has been met, at least in the sense you can measure that with accounting data, has, I think, made some people feel confident about, re-regulating the industry. Regulators regulate. That's what they do. And I think that the STB searching around for something to do, and I think part of that's related to the stability or return. It's not, I wouldn't call it stable, but certainly the healthier the sector that they have now has made them feel a little more comfortable about intervening But I think if you look at the data that the industry is not in a situation of earning excessive returns that would justify intervention.
Thanks, George. And that brings us to sort of the segue into our next part of the discussion, which is, as we've just discussed, the purpose of the Staggers Act is ostensibly to lead to deregulation of the rail industry. But I think one of the lessons if the law of regulation holds true, that even when one tries to deregulate, there is going to be inevitably regulatory creep. And we've certainly seen that at the Surface Transportation Board. And I think it's important to recognize and sort of discuss what they're trying to do. Because again, if one is holding out rail regulation as a model, then one, we have the issue of regulatory creep, which I just mentioned. But this is one of the things that I find exceedingly frustrating. Just my background is I got my start doing electric utility rate cases. As I like to joke, I'm not proud of my rate making background, but I have one. Tim obviously spends his life doing rate cases over at the STB. And George has been involved in rate cases. And what I think a lot of people miss when they talk about rate regulation is that regulation just isn't, when the government sets the price, you just can't do so in a vacuum. You immediately bring in the due process and the taking provisions of the Fifth Amendment. You cannot escape that. There are rules, you know, the regulations when you have tariffs and that kind of stuff is to protect as much the regulated as it is to protect, as to govern the conduct of the regulator. And what's been interesting to me is that the regulatory creep at the STB, where you had a lot of folks, essentially try and bypass that and take shortcuts. And I think that raises a lot of very significant due process concerns. And so I wanted to talk about that a little bit with folks on the call. There's been two, I'm sure there's a couple of other ones that Tim could probably talk about, but the two that have sort of struck me, and I've done some writing on this, and we'll get to both, is one is called switched access or reciprocal access, and the other one is what they call final offer rate review. So let's start with what they call reciprocal access. Reciprocal access is essentially where they would mandate access at a regulated price. And the Staggers Act is very clear that they never wanted to have a switched access mechanism as just as a normal way of doing business. Again, it was supposed to be deregulatory. They had a provision in there that you could have switched access if it was shown to have some sort of to remedy a specific anti-competitive harm. But I guess at the end of the Obama administration, they issued a notice of proposed rulemaking, which from my understanding, and Tim, correct me, is still sort of sitting there during the Trump administration, that they would essentially force switched access and change the anti-competitive standard to a more general standard to get around the statute. So, Tim, why don't you talk about that for a second real quick, and then we can get into sort of the law and economics of that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And just, I'll try to stay at a pretty high level. It gets down the weeds pretty quickly. But so just the notion of reciprocal switching is a railroad serves a facility and then switches a car to somebody else to complete the long haul transportation. And it's referred to as reciprocal switching because railroads tend to do this for each other via commercial arrangements. Where market conditions, make that in both parties' interests. There is a provision in the statute that allows the agency to order switching in certain circumstances, and there is both rulemaking and ICC precedent that sort of established the rules of the road for when the agency was going to intervene and force a railroad that serves a plant to hand over its that traffic to a competitor. As Larry says, that standard has been an anti-competitive one. That is, the agency would sort of order a railroad to turn over the traffic after a showing of competitive abuse, it's not something that's been used at the agency. There's a theme running through some of the activities at the STB that if a remedy has not been used, that indicates a problem, and that therefore they need to then change the rules. And so, as Larry says, at the end of the Obama administration, they came out with a notice of proposed rulemaking, which would set different standards for when switching would be ordered. And would remove that sort of competitive abuse requirement. And it has, you know, we AAR filed comments in that proceeding and obviously opposed it, and it has been dormant since then. I do think it sort of illustrates a sort of fundamental question of sort of when is it appropriate for government to intervene in markets. And when what are the right circumstances to trigger sort of dictating to a railroad what service that they provide? Keep in mind that switching a rail car is a labor-intensive activity. There's physical work to sort of attach a locomotive, move cars, use the right facilities to move that car around. You can't just do a K-turn in the parking lot. There's work to do that. And essentially there is inefficiencies every time a rail car is handled. So sort of the most efficient and most cost-effective way to move a rail car is to move it from origin to destination and to handle it as few times as possible. And so when is it necessary for the government to step in and order that type of inefficient behavior? I think we made a compelling case that should be a very rare instance.
Let me turn it over to George and ask that. I mean, you know, one of the things that the STB said is, you know, by simply getting rid of the, an anti-competitive problem, it seems to me that if you don't have to demonstrate a market failure before you intervene in the market, if there's no market failure remedy, then what's the point of regulation? They also say, like, well, you know, look at all the mergers that have happened, but didn't they approve all the mergers in the first place? I mean, does this make sense from the economist's point of view of, you know, when do we regulate and when do we not regulate?
Well, I think you have to, as you mentioned earlier, respect the complexity of regulating correctly, particularly when you're regulating price. I think demonstrating some sort of failure, some market failure that requires intervention should be required in pretty much any case. That can get really complicated when you're dealing with multiple products and firms running to cargo along different routes and prices varying in complex ways sometimes about how do you define the relevant vector of prices that are problematic and what are the costs. I mean, those are very, very complicated questions. And then overriding the whole thing is this revenue adequacy constraint, which I think really is probably the most sensible way to approach the industry and with multi-product firms competing, about the only result that economics can point to is that competitive firms will earn economic return. You can't really say a whole lot about individual prices sometimes. So picking and choosing a price and along one route or for a particular cargo sort of misses the point, I think, in regulating the multi-product firm. So I think that's a big problem. I think much of what you read that the STB has written about this and what other people say about it kind of comes from that idea that that we don't really have a good way of doing this, and so we're going to do it anyway. I think that's a, you know, almost certainly a recipe for disaster, particularly with reciprocal switching, because as Tim mentioned, you're going to introduce inefficiencies. We had the same thing in telecommunications with the unbundling regime and trying to manually remove physical plant from its connections to move it around and plug it into something else, which was just turned out to be horribly inefficient, not to mention the fact that they just couldn't be done fast enough to really have a viable competitive scenario resulting from it. So it's you have to respect, I think, the difficulty of figuring out where you might want to regulate, but if it's difficult to figure out where you might want to regulate, it's going to be really, really difficult to regulate correctly. And I think that's really going to be the hurdle. And you know, you may want to regulate, and I think some people certainly do. And there are shippers who are complaining about rates as they will. I mean, anytime you have a regulatory body, there's going to be somebody complaining to it, trying to get something from them. That there's going to be this attempt or desire to serve a constituency or just feel like you're doing something good. But as the more complex the problem looks, and if you're trying to avoid that complexity, it is highly likely that the regulation is going to be very inefficient and cause a lot of side effect.
Let me throw this, sort of following up on that, let me throw this question out to both of you. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, there is rate-making provisions in the Staggers Act to be used, but yet here's a way, I think, where the regulator is looking for something to do or essentially trying to short-circuit that process with a very thin veil. Doesn't that present some sort of danger where we just start, you know, reinventing the statute or sort of ignoring the provisions that Congress put in there? Again, the rate regulation, rate statutes are there primarily to ensure they govern the conduct of the regulator, but they're there to protect the due process rights of the regulated. Tim, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think any sort of effort to sort of circumvent the protections of a statute in the rate-making world by ordering certain service is going to be problematic. I think the question of reciprocal switching is again, sort of when you're sort of thinking about the fundamental role of the agency, is it to remedy market failures and to punish anti-competitive conduct and thereby sort of promote competition in the marketplace? Or is it some sort of affirmative responsibility to create competition where it doesn't exist? And sort of in the rail world, we've got a number of different things that make that notion of creating competition extremely complicated. One is sort of the really high fixed costs of running a railroad. So sort of after people have put, a company has put tracks in the ground to enter a facility or enter a market, to turn around and then sort of turn that over to a competitor presents a lot of potential problems. And then also sort of a myopic view of competition. You know, George mentioned the multi-product firm. You know, you've got railroads providing freight transportation service, but the competitive landscape is not limited to railroads, right? I mean, there's obviously truck competition. There is barge competition. Railroads are one piece of a global logistics network. And then there's also competitive forces in the world, you know, products that can be substituted and shipments that could move from other locations, so indirect competitive forces. So sort of myopically looking at one plant and deciding that you're going to put your thumb on the scale to force one railroad to turn over traffic to another is going to create ripple effects throughout the network and cause bad results.
All right, great. Thanks, guys. Okay, well, that brings me then to the second issue, which is this issue. It's a concept that the STB has introduced called final offer rate review, which to oversimplify, and I'll let Tim explain, but it's sort of imposing baseball style arbitration for rate making. In full disclosure, I did a piece for the Federal Society Review. You can get it on the FedSox webpage, entitled Ensuring Due Process at the Surface Transportation Board. And I'll get into this discussion in a minute where I read this thing and it just smacked of one due process violation after another. And so, Tim, why don't you explain what that rulemaking, what their proposal is essentially to do, and then we'll sort of take off from there.
Sure. Maybe it'd be helpful if I took a step back to and just sort of talk about the rate regulation regime at the STB, and then sort of how FOR kind of fits in or doesn't fit in with that. So coming out of Staggers in the early 80s, the ICC was struggling to articulate a standard for what constitutes a reasonable rate. You know, we talked about sort of the due process requirements of just and reasonable rates, as well as the requirements that Congress put on the agency with revenue adequacy and sort of instructions to allow competition and demand for service to regulate rates. So it was struggling to find a way to set a standard. And in 1985, they came out with a decision called Coal Rate Guidelines, and despite the name, it applies to all traffic. And they established four different constraints on railroad pricing. The most notable of those is a standalone cost test. But essentially, they said there would be four constraints on pricing. One would be a management efficiency constraint, that customers shouldn't pay for inefficiencies of management. One was a standalone cost constraint. That is, rail carriers should not charge more than a hypothetical efficient entrant to the market would charge if there were no barriers to entry. And then a revenue adequacy constraint, which was not defined, but a notion that some or all of a differential above competitive prices should be constrained if a railroad were to achieve long-term revenue accuracy. The fourth constraint was phasing, that is, a large rate increase could be phased in over time. Of those constraints, the standalone cost test was really the one used by litigants at the agency and sort of a case law developed over time, enhanced by rulemaking to flesh out how a complainant would show what a market entrant would charge to carry the traffic and any other traffic grouped together over the facilities necessary to serve it. As you can imagine, that's a difficult thing to do. Markets are complex, railroads are complex, and to understand the facilities necessary to serve traffic, a fair amount of evidence has to be put in the record. Because it's a independent commission, the ICC and the board tended to take a balls and strikes approach to evidence rather than sort of putting out exactly what should be shown. Parties were sort of free to develop their own cases. That led to pretty protracted and expensive litigation. And so over the years, the agency has been struggling with simplified and expedited ways to set rates. Over the years, they've come up with two simplifications, a simplified standalone cost test, which is essentially taking various shortcuts to get at the cost to provide service, and what they call a three benchmark test, which is really a rate comparison using data that the agency collects about revenues and variable costs, and comparing the complaint about traffic to a benchmark group of similar traffic. Again, the agency has opined that they're not seeing enough cases, that standalone costs is expensive to bring, and they've had very few of these simplified cases, so they want to do something else. They've proposed final offer rate review, which, as Larry says, is akin to baseball-style arbitration in that the agency has supposed that parties would offer their best offers, and then the agency would then pick among the two for the maximum lawful rate. So that was a notice of proposed rulemaking. We have participated in that proceeding as well, opposing that proposal. At a very high level, I mean, it poses a number of questions and problems, not least of which it skips an important question, which is the paradigm that the STB operates is a complaint-driven one. That is, a complainant brings a rate case to the agency and bears a burden of proof of showing that rate is unreasonable. And FORR would sort of take this notion of I'm not even sure how to phrase it, that everything is potentially unreasonable, and one side comes up with an offer, the other side comes up with an offer, and that the agency will judge it based on either its existing standards or under standards and evidence that parties cook up in this litigation. There are other problems associated with sort of timing. There's very limited time for defendants to reply. And so it's problematic on a variety of levels.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me, again, just sort of in this effort to make bringing, you said, it's funny, you said that, like, we're not seeing a lot of cases, so it's sort of, that's sort of the first signal to me that a regulator is searching for purpose. But, you know, there were a couple of things that sort of struck me about this. You know, sort of basic rate making is that, you know, regulators, they usually have great latitude in choosing the methodology that they can bring. It could be total element, long run incremental cost, rate of return, price gap, whatever you want, you know. But litigants need to know the rules of the road going in. You know, tell me what the methodology is, and that's it. The Supreme Court has held that, you know, you got to do that. But yet, under this proposal, it's sort of one side could use one methodology and the other side could make methodology, and then they'll go, well, we'll figure that out later. That seems to just smack of just a huge due process problem to me, among others. What do you think about that, Tim?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if you take a step back and think about a legal regime where you don't know the outcome, you don't even know the rule until after the case is decided, it's obviously problematic. I mean, it is impossible for a company to conform its behavior to comply with the law if they don't know the test that's going to be applied at the back end.
Yeah, and along a similar line, it's like, well, you know, the APA says you've got to have a hearing. How do you have a hearing if it's just, I'll submit an offer and have a nice day?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, George, you know, having been an economist in rate cases, I mean, how do you prep for something like that? How do you even...
Well, it's hard to say until you know more about how the process would proceed. I suspect the way it would go from a legal perspective, given the due process concerns, at least I would hope, is that you would have to come in and demonstrate that your offer is a legal one, which means you're going to have to use the existing methodologies and not some new one, or you might be using new methodology, but you certainly have to demonstrate that it would be compatible with the old, so it means you're going to have to do the old too. But I don't see how – I mean, I see some legal risk of a regulatory agency saying, you know, we got two offers and we took one of them, but we don't have an extensive record to demonstrate that this is a legal rate, would be very that sounds to me like a train wreck waiting to happen.
Pardon the pun.
Pardon the pun. But it's just hard to say until you do it. But I think what you have to end up doing is do what you would have done without it, because you're going to have to demonstrate that this satisfies a legal rate. You can't just say, I think it's a dollar. You know, I mean, you're going to have to prove that that's satisfies revenue adequacy or standalone cost test or whatever it is that has been established as legitimate. So I don't know if it really changes a whole lot in the end, or even reduces the burden on the parties. In fact, if anything, it probably increased the burden on the parties, because not only do they have to demonstrate that it satisfies what is a known legal standard, but I've got to produce some new analysis as well. So, it's one of those things you kind of look at it and think, you know, this is a, you know, baseball arbitration is one of those ideas that people throw around a lot in regulatory space, primarily because it kind of gets they're trying to get the regulator out of it for the most part, or the regulatory process out of it. But, you know, when you start really thinking about applying it, it runs into a lot of problems, which is why you don't see more of it. I mean, only if you're really, the regulator has a great deal of flexibility in how it sets rates, would you be able to use it, which is why it's just not done all that often.
All right. Well, in the remaining minutes we have, I want to sort of wrap this up, and if we have time, open it up to a couple questions. But let's sort of, you know, bring back to what the purpose of the panel is, and that is, are there lessons to be learned from 40 years of the Staggers Act? Has it worked? Do we see, with the best efforts of deregulation, will the inevitability, unless you actually, a lot of people say about regulation, the only way is you got to take a vampire approach to it, drive a heart through it, kill it, otherwise it will come back. What have we learned? So Tim, let's start with you. What do you think?
Well, I think we've learned a number of things. I mean, first of all, looking back even beyond the 40 years of Staggers, we've learned that sort of heavy-handed regulation tends to distort outcomes and is a poor tool to use in markets that are innovating and changing and evolving. I think in the Staggers Act, you see a wisdom in recognizing that markets are efficient and lead to good outcomes. We've seen a number of just tremendous sort of results in the 40 years after Staggers. Railroads productivity has soared, rates, measured in the aggregate over time have declined. Railroads have gained market share, intercity freight. Railroads have been free to invest in their private networks and done so in big numbers. There have been huge increases in safety as railroads had the capital to invest in their networks and to invest in facilities. You've seen tremendous strides in safety. And you've seen a dynamic shift in the industry. A lot of the regulatory talk focuses on the number of Class I railroads, and you mentioned mergers. But there is an entire industry of short line railroads that was created after Staggers, leading to innovation and other good things. So, I think we see a paradigm that's been wildly successful. We have to be vigilant going forward to make sure that those gains are kept and progressed, and that we don't see backsliding into sort of some of the bad old days.
Thanks, Tim. And George, if you could give us the economist's perspective on this.
Well, I mean, regulation is price regulation is for monopolies. And I don't think you can argue that the rail industry is a monopoly in transportation. There may be particular routes and things that rail is superior at handling. But, you know, you're starting to get into small pieces of a large business, and you have to wonder whether or not having regulatory intervention in those markets is worthwhile, particularly when, you know, maybe those markets that help ensure the revenue adequacy for the company as a whole. I think that the thing to do at some point when you have an industry that has moved on from a state of monopoly to competition is that you really have to start thinking about curbing the regulatory authority significantly. We've had to do that in railroads already. I think the competitive conditions have only gotten stronger over time. So it may be time again to curb regulatory authority in the railroad business rather than increase it, as some people propose. Mainly because if you have a regulator, there are going to be people come in and ask it to do things, and they're going to want to, some of them at least, are going to want to be active, and you just have to, you know, decide it. It may be time, you know, to severely curtail the ability of the regulator to act that way. I know there are certainly things in the railroad business that may need some oversight, and even the railroad industry itself may prefer to have somebody there to help coordinate parts of the business. But I don't see any evidence in the return data, revenue adequacy data, that would suggest it's time to start regulating the railroad business. I mean, I think it's a situation that's finally gotten to some sort of financial stability, and if you start regulating it again, I think you're going to end up with a lot of trouble.
All right. Well, all right. Great. Thanks. Well, let's see if we have in the 5 minutes we have left on the hour. Let's see if we have any questions. Nick, do we have any questions at all?
Okay, let's go to it now. No one's on yet, Larry. So might be only a couple minutes left, but I'll give you a chance for any remarks you've got in the meantime. In case we get one, we'll go to it, but otherwise we'll wrap up.
I think we will bring it, actually, to use the old provision, we're bringing the train right in on time, which is always a good thing. Well, listen, I want to thank our guests, Tim Strafford, George Ford. I know I learned a lot. I thought this was an excellent discussion, and I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for hosting that. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.